Hello, and welcome to this Open Systems Media webinar titled, Don't Architect a Real-Time System That Can't Scale. I'm Mike Demmler, Editorial Director for Open Systems Media's DSP-FPGA.com website and our monthly DSP-FPGA Digest newsletter. I will be serving as the moderator for this webinar. I would like to start with an introduction to our topic today. As distributed systems scale up, so does the time and cost associated with their integration. The integration challenge is particularly acute for real-time and intelligent systems, where increased connectivity cannot come at the expense of performance, reliability, or resource consumption. The solution for building systems that encompass ever more applications, nodes, and real-time data is to adopt an inherently scalable architecture. In this webinar, you will learn how you can apply proven integration techniques, such as loose coupling and service orientation, to demanding real-time systems. Our presenter will introduce a scalable architecture that is appropriate for systems spanning embedded, high-performance, and IT applications. Now, before we get started, I have just a few housekeeping items. Today's presentation will consume about 50 minutes, leaving us 10 minutes or so for questions at the end. There are several on-screen buttons that I'd like to bring to your attention. First, by clicking on the Enlarge Slides button, you will be able to view the slides in full screen mode. You will also find a button on your screen that enables you to download a copy of the slides. There is a Forward to a Friend button that you can use to send an email to a colleague to invite them to join us for this live event. Finally, you will also find on your console window a button that allows you to enter questions in real time. We'll do our best to answer all of your questions during the closing Q&A session. If you have a question pertaining to the webcast operation itself, one of our technicians will respond back to you during the presentation. We may not get to all of your questions before the end of our allotted time, but in that case, someone will get back to you after the webcast with more information. Finally, this webcast will be posted online shortly after this event, and an audio podcast will also be made available. We'll have more details about that at the end. So on to the presentation. Our speaker today is David Barnett, Vice President of Products and Markets at RTI, where he is responsible for product planning and industry development. David has been at RTI for more than 6 years and has been involved with real-time systems for more than 25 years. Prior to RTI, he held product management and marketing positions with several leading providers of real-time middleware and real-time operating systems. He began his career as a software engineer and lead at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, where he was responsible for the implementation of several distributed real-time systems. Over to you, David.
Thank you, Mike, and thank you, everyone, for joining us today. Before I start introducing our topic of architecting scalable real-time systems, I did want to give you a very brief introduction to RTI and our experience in this space. RTI is the leading provider of communications middleware for designed specifically for real-time systems. Our software is used today in over 500 unique commercial products as the integration infrastructure. We also, in addition to that, support several hundred research projects, and it's deployed today in over 350,000 different devices and applications. RTI is very committed to standards. We participate in more than 15 different standards organizations, and I'll be talking a little bit about some of those in this presentation. And we are the author of the Data Distribution Service, or DDS, standard from the Object Management Group. So today I'm going to focus on scalable architectures for real-time systems, and I wanted to provide, you know, a brief definition of what I mean when I talk about real-time systems. So by a real-time system, I'm really referring to systems such as those depicted here that interact with, you know, what we would call the real world. So they have to operate at the speed of physical processes, and they generally control physical assets. So they don't just operate at the speed of human users, They typically have to react and keep up with data that's significantly faster than that because it's coming from physical processes that need to be managed at a much greater rate, you know, typically on the order of, you know, milliseconds or even, you know, microseconds in some cases. So these could be applications, you know, classic planes, trains, and automobiles, so controlling automotive systems, transportation management, unmanned vehicles, medical equipment, a lot of defense applications, for example. And what's key about these systems is that it's very critical that the software infrastructure be able to keep up with the pace of data and control whatever physical process is being managed. For example, in a manufacturing plant, you've got to be able to, everything is very periodic and has to be able to be controlled in real time. So this is what I mean by a real-time system. It's, you know, faster than human speed that it needs to operate at. And these types of systems go by many names. So in addition to real-time systems, they're often called operational technology systems, intelligent systems, and it generally incorporates components that could be running within an embedded system. So some of the unique characteristics of real-time systems that really differentiates them from traditional IT systems is that they are very time sensitive. So if you think about, for example, a shopping site, so on a, you know, popular shopping day of the year, so in the United States it's the day after our Thanksgiving holiday is the biggest online shopping day of the year. You know, if I go to do an internet transaction, internet retailer, and because it's a busy day, it might take 2 seconds to process my transaction instead of taking 1 second to process my transaction, they're probably not going to lose me as a customer. It's fine that you can queue that transaction until the server has the processor bandwidth to process it. So going from 1 second to 2 seconds isn't a big deal. But when you're controlling a physical process, you don't have that luxury. You've got to be able to keep up with that process. And in fact, typically what happens is when data rates go up, rather than being able to queue the data, that usually means that something interesting is going on. And when data rates go up, it actually becomes even more latency to bound the time required to process that data. So ironically, rather than being able to sort of slow down or queue data during peak loads, you actually need to ensure that your system can actually handle data at peak loads, because that's when processing that data typically becomes most critical. So real-time systems generally require low latency and either bounded latency or certainly visibility into how latency is behaving in the system of processing data. Usually have to accommodate, you know, very high throughput, so they could be dealing literally with, you know, millions of different data types or data updates per second. Generally require nonstop availability. So, you know, typically in an IT system, when you fail over, you know, I can take, you know, a few seconds or in some cases a few minutes to fail over, say, from my primary server or database to a backup. But in a real-time system, that's non-tenable. You've got to be able to fail over instantly. In fact, ideally, you know, there's no failover required. It really has to run continuously, because even being shut off for a few milliseconds, depending on the application, could really have a calamitous impact. They also tend to require much more dynamic and ad hoc and autonomous behavior than a traditional IT application. So when I plug a device into my factory floor network, for example, I don't necessarily want to have to call a system administrator to go configure that. I want to be able to plug it in and have it work immediately. And another characteristic is that typically components of real-time systems are running outside the traditional enterprise data center. So the processing tends to be much more distributed, and you don't often in a real-time system have the luxury of running over, you know, a very thick, high-bandwidth network. So you can't count on having Ethernet or gigabit Ethernet. They often have to run in environments where the network might be intermittent or very high delay or low bandwidth. So they have to accommodate a much greater diversity of underlying network types than a traditional IT application would have to do. So there are many dimensions to scalability, because one of the big trends today is certainly that the scale of these real-time systems is increasing significantly. So real-time systems have gone from sort of running within a single box with really standalone equipment to small distributed networks that still might be primarily running, you know, at a single location, now to really interconnected systems of systems, where you're dealing with an order of magnitude more data types, devices, and independently developed systems than you traditionally had, you know, even say 20 years ago. And this is there's no end in sight as people move to, you know, the Internet of Things. The level of interconnection and the amount of data available to these applications is going to continue to explode as the users of these systems really strive to have, you know, greater situational awareness to make better decisions, better optimized processes, be more responsive for competitive reasons. And in addition, you know, given that generally this equipment is expensive or controlling things that are expensive, you know, have much better predictive maintenance and optimized utilization of equipment. So all of this is driving much greater interconnection and much greater data sharing between these systems. In addition to the physical dimension of scale, the dimension I'm actually going to talk as much about today is as you start to connect more things, those things aren't just running on more CPUs with more applications, they're also developed by more people. So there's more developers that now have to have components of software that they're developing working together. They could span, you know, more organizations, you know, both within an enterprise or even across enterprises. So what I'm going to talk about today, as much as the physical aspects of how you scale, is how do you scale development in terms of the number of individuals and organizations that are contributing content to this systems of systems, because that really becomes as much a problem and a challenge as how do you physically scale the network topology of these systems. So to step back for a minute and look at how real-time systems and even systems in general were traditionally integrated, it's, you know, what I often call point-to-point integration or application-centric integration. So if each of these sort of circles on this diagram represents an application, basically every application had something of a direct connection to every other application that it had to communicate with, either to share data, process commands. And that's often manageable in a very small system. If I have very few applications, there's very few potential connections. But an implication of this is that, you know, when I add a new application to a system, so indicated by the red dot here, I often have to then go back and do some re-engineering or rework on those other applications that connects to, because they now have to know how to communicate with that application. Or if one of these is an older application, I've got to go do reverse engineering to figure out, well, how do I talk to that application? The person that developed it isn't here anymore. Likewise, if I want to change the implementation or functionality of an application, for example, the one that just turned orange there, I similarly have to go back and rework other existing applications in order to be able to communicate with this. So while for an initial system that consists of very few applications, this approach might be viable, the reality is as you scale up, it becomes incredibly complex because it basically becomes an order n squared problem. If I have, you know, n applications, I have n squared potential connections between those applications. So in practice, as systems get very large, it becomes almost impossible to evolve or maintain them using this approach to integration, and as a result, you tend to get very little reuse, and because it's so costly to add new applications, you get very limited information sharing between applications because all communication is explicit in this model. I can't get any data for free. In order to get data, I've got to go do rework on existing applications, so it tends to limit the amount of data that in practice you share between applications to just that data that's critical. So basically what happens with this order n squared integration problem is, you know, over time as systems grow in scale and become more complex just because they've evolved over time, is the time and cost to integrate them, maintain them, upgrade them, you know, goes up significantly. And, you know, with many projects for systems that have been deployed for a number of years, you know, really integration costs completely dominate the overall cost of the system. And, you know, often you just don't want to touch them because they're so brittle over time, that, you know, any change has potentially unintended consequences. So you tend to minimize the amount of significant maintenance or upgrades you do to existing systems just because it's unaffordable. So what I'm going to talk about today is really six keys to developing and implementing a much more scalable architecture for real-time systems. And the first of these is to move away from what I was calling application-centric or point-to-point integration, where applications specifically talk to each other, to a publish-subscribe model for communication, With the publish-subscribe model, it's not necessary for individual applications to have any direct knowledge of any other applications. So applications don't directly communicate with each other. So if I'm building a sensor, for example, I don't need to know, oh, I'm sending the sensor data to a control application or to an actuator or to a human-machine interface application, an HMI application. All I need to know about, well, I'm a sensor and I produce sensor data. So data producers just publish the data that they produce. Then a consumer of that data doesn't have to have knowledge of where that data is coming from. A consumer of the data just subscribes to the data it needs. So, for example, in this example shown here, I have a sensor. It's publishing sensor data. I have a control application that needs access to that sensor data. It's subscribing to sensor data. Now, it might notionally know that that data is coming from a sensor, but it doesn't need to know anything about the fact that it's coming from that sensor. It actually could just as easily be coming from a simulator, for example. So it's just subscribing to sensor data, doing some processing on that sensor data, publishing some commands, and those commands then maybe are going to an actuator that's responding to that, whatever the controller is detecting. So the applications themselves now are actually decoupled. They don't contain any knowledge of each other. They only contain knowledge of the types of data that are exchanged between applications. So as an example here, if I add another sensor to my network, so the work that was being done by one sensor, I'm now distributing over two sensors. I don't have to go change my control application when I add another sensor. I just now have another producer of sensor data on my network, and that control application is automatically getting that sensor data. So I've added an application, but I haven't had to now go change any existing applications. Likewise, I may want to add an HMI to this system that's actually displaying what's going on. So I can add that display application. It can be showing my operators, well, this is the value of each temperature sensor in my system. Likewise, it could be also displaying what's the status as detected, maybe by a control application or an actuator, but it's just tapping into that data that already exists in my system. None of my existing applications need to be modified to know that I've now added a display application. So it makes these systems very evolvable because as I add new applications, I don't have to go rework any existing application. They just, if they're producing new data, they just become another publisher on the network. If they're subscribing data, they just become another data consumer on the network. But that's completely transparent to any application that's already deployed. So integration now goes from being an order n squared problem as a function of the number of applications in my system, where it's now really independent of the number of applications in my system. It's really more of a function of the number of different data flows in my system. And any even given application only needs to know about the data it produces or consumes. It doesn't need to know about how that data is being produced or what a consumer of that data is doing. So as an example, maybe I want to now go to this network and add another application that's doing, say, predictive maintenance to take advantage of this sensor data and status information to figure out what's the health of my equipment. So this is a new application that I may not have anticipated when I originally architected this system. Now I can just go add that predictive maintenance application to this without having to go make any changes to any of the existing applications that are already deployed. So it's very scalable approach from that perspective. The next key is for the data that's being exchanged between applications to have a very explicit and well-defined data model. And what I mean by that is that different developers or integrators that are either building these different components or connecting these components together need to understand how that data is actually being interpreted and exchanged to ensure that applications truly semantically interoperate. So for example, if I say I have, an attribute called speed, and I just say, well, speed is a floating point number, that's not that meaningful out of context because you don't know is speed, is that miles per hour, is that knots, is it meters per second? So speed itself doesn't have meaning. Moreover, what's it in reference, in relation to? Is it ground speed? Is it air speed? So to really have applications, developers and integrators really make applications talk to each other, they actually have to understand the semantics that underlie the individual data being exchanged. Because if they don't know the semantics of the data that's being published, then they can't ensure that they're actually interpreting that data correctly. For example, in a subscriber, or if I'm publishing data and I have a data model, I don't know that I'm publishing data in the format that's being expected by a subscriber. So what's really key is to, separately from the implementation of any application, have an abstract, explicit data model that effectively provides the ground rules or the definition of data that different developers or integrators will use to build their component of the system, so that there's a complete universally understood meaning of data as it's exchanged between applications. And again, this data should be independent of its implementation in any specific application. So if it's necessary to mediate between what's used, for example, for integration and what's used in a specific application, you know, you can do that, but you need to make sure that the data that somebody's connecting to is understood by that person that has to write the software or integration logic that's connecting to that application. The next key is to maintain the shared state of a system externally or independently to any actual application. And I relate this to the traditional use of a database, although you said I'm not suggesting when I talk about implementation later that you actually use a database, but logically an advantage that a database provides to a system is a consistent view of state across all applications. If every application is sharing a database, you know that they have the same view of the world. And what happens in a distributed system is if you maintain separate state in every application, there's a good likelihood that that state will start to become disconnected between different applications, and applications might become out of sync. To ensure that different applications stay synchronized, it's important that the state, sort of the system-wide single version of truth, not be maintained within any application, or worse, replicated across all applications. That single version of truth should be maintained at the infrastructure level for the system, not within each individual application. And one big advantage that this provides is you now get temporal decoupling between different applications, because if I'm synchronizing with a global state rather than having to maintain my own state, it really doesn't matter when an application joins a system. I can join a system and have missed messages, but if I can get a snapshot of the current state of the system, then it doesn't really matter that I've lost messages. So it really decouples, and again, this is important in a real-time system that can be very dynamic or ad hoc, it decouples when subscribers to data join a system when the actual real state of the system is maintained in the infrastructure. And this really becomes key for scaling up as you scale up a system to having that system be robust in a dynamic environment, is having that single version of truth maintained at the infrastructure level so that every application has the same current view of the world. To understand this a little better, I think it helps to sort of contrast this with traditional approaches. So really what we're saying by maintaining a common version of state is what we call the data-centric approach to integration, is that the infrastructure manages data and the life cycle of that data. So what applications do is they basically have a standard set of operations that they do on data. For example, creating a new data object. So for example, a sensor might join the network, and now there's, you know, sensor data that might be coming from a different location. So it's going to basically create a new sensor data feed. And then the middleware can now manage the life cycle of that feed. So as it updates, for example, the value of the data, it's updating the centrally shared state of that data. Likewise, it can then go delete the data, and anyone that depended on that data can know, hey, the sensor or application that was producing that data is no longer available in the system. So it's providing a standard set of operations across data that are universally understood across all the applications or services in a system. So again, applications themselves don't have to have any logic to maintain the state. They're just accessing that shared state in the system. So this is in contrast to what we call the more traditional message-centric approach. And with the message-centric approach, I'm just sending messages about data between applications rather than maintaining a central, you know, cache of the value of all the data objects in my system. So basically, instead of having a standard set of operations on data, applications just send messages and receive messages. And it's now delegated to an application logic or really application-level protocol, how I interpret those messages. So basically, my messages have to have as content of the message, well, the purpose of this message is to tell you that there's a new data object and maybe this is initial value, and the purpose of this next message is to update some fields of that data value. So now what happens is I need application logic to interpret those messages, and moreover, now I've got to maintain the state, the shared state of my system in application logic, so that every update I'm properly registering in my application data structures. And what happens now is if I become disconnected and lose messages, my state can now get out of sync with the rest of the system, because what's critical with this sort of traditional message-centric approach is you can't lose any messages because there's nowhere in the system to go back and say, wait, what's the value of this data object? I might have missed some updates. So what this means is you have to do one of two things. I either need to persist every single message in the system, which is rarely tenable in a large-scale real-time system because there's just too much data. When you're dealing with millions of data updates per second, you really can't persist all of that data. After a few seconds, you'd overwhelm whatever resources you might have to store that data. So it's very rare in a real-time system you actually have the resources or, frankly, the time based on latency requirements to actually persist all the data in a system. So if you can't persist all the data with this approach, then you need to use some central infrastructure, or again, an application-level protocol to say, okay, give me a snapshot of data independent of the infrastructure. And again, that's now leading to very complex application logic to get save state and then synchronize that with shared state, as opposed to the data-centric approach where as soon as I become a subscriber, I immediately just get that current snapshot of data, as shown on the left there. So application logic becomes much simpler, it's much more efficient, and systems are just much more robust and scalable than sort of repeating the work of state maintenance in each application. The next key to developing a scalable real-time system is to make sure that your infrastructure is capable of managing real-time quality of service. Because, as we talked about earlier, a key attribute of real-time systems is the need for determinism and control over timing, or as a minimum, visibility over timing in the system. Because if deadlines aren't being met, you certainly need to know that in your application. If I expect to get data every millisecond and I'm not getting data every millisecond, that could be a sign of a problem, and I want to know that I'm not getting data every millisecond because I may need to take action as a result of that. So, for example, if a key sensor is down or a key actuator is down, I might want to shut down my manufacturing line, for example, as quickly as possible so that nothing calamitous happens. Another characteristic is that applications may have very different quality of service requirements. So, for example, a sensor might be publishing data 1,000 times a second, 1,000 hertz, but a display application or HMI application certainly doesn't want to display data 1,000 times a second. It only wants to display data once a second, and in fact, it might be running on a platform that's incapable of actually receiving data or processing data 1,000 times a second. Now, if the infrastructure isn't managing this communication and mediating between the different quality of service requirements of this application, what happens is that knowledge of applications starts creeping back into other applications and you start to get coupling again. So, for example, if I'm building a sensor and I know I'm producing data at 1,000 times a second, but some application can only take data one time a second, well, then maybe I have to create two data feeds if I don't have quality of service managed by the infrastructure, which becomes very inefficient to now say, okay, now I've got to publish data once for applications that need it at 1,000 hertz, another time for applications that need it at 1 hertz, another time maybe for applications that need it at 100 hertz. And again, now you're back to sort of the original situation where you've got all this knowledge of other applications embedded in the logic of your application, which you really don't want. By having an infrastructure that can manage quality of service, you've now kept this application logic or the needs of applications decoupled again from other applications, and the infrastructure then becomes responsible for mediating between different quality of service requirements and, just as importantly, letting a given application know when its quality of service requirements aren't being met so that appropriate action can be taken by that application. So again, it's visibility into quality of service is just as important in a real-time system as control over quality of service. So just an example of some of the things that, you know, we mean by quality of service, or real-time quality of service. So I've kind of broken them into some categories here, but for example, on, you know, the volatility of data. So is data durable? How long do I want to keep data around? For example, how much history of a specific data object do I want to keep for late joiners? So for example, when a new application joins the system, does it just need the latest value of a particular data object? So does it just need the last temperature reading, or does it need some history of temperature readings in order to kind of bootstrap whatever processing it is? So it's not just sort of like a traditional database where I have the last value. It, you know, could be more functionality like a historian where I need the last N values or the values over the last period of time in order for a late joining application or an application that might have been disconnected from the network for a while to sort of get the level of state that it needs to do its processing. Similarly, data might also have a specific lifespan. So if I'm publishing data 1,000 times a second, that data may only be valid. I might want somebody to only look at it if it's a very fast-changing process. I don't want somebody to look at that data 2 seconds from now because that data could be meaningless 2 seconds from now. So I want data to automatically sort of expire from that central state when it's no longer valid or valuable to anybody. Similarly, there could be very different delivery requirements around data. So some applications might need data completely reliably. You can't miss a single sample. So again, if I've got an algorithm that's making decisions on the changing value of sensor data, that algorithm may not allow me to miss any data samples. If it needs data 1,000 times a second, it needs to get data 1,000 times a second. Again, a display application, if it misses a data sample, that might be fine. It's not going to, my human operator probably won't notice if it updates, you know, after 2 seconds or 1.5 seconds instead of updating, you know, precisely once a second. So you can tolerate some loss, and by accommodating that in the infrastructure and saying, okay, I don't need to resend data to you if it got lost in the network or at the OS layer, you can make your system overall much more efficient if every application is allowed to specify its own reliability, quality of service, for example. And kind of the example I talked to earlier is time-based filtering applications, you know, need data at different rates. So you, when you subscribe to data, you don't want to necessarily subscribe to all data. You just want to subscribe to data at the periodicity that you care about. Likewise, you might only, an application might only care about data that has certain content. For example, if I've got, you know, an application that's going to send an alarm, you know, some threshold's exceeded, I don't care about temperature if it's, say, under 100 degrees, but I do want to know if the temperature gets, you know, to 101 degrees or 105 degrees, so I can basically subscribe to temperature data, but just say, only give me temperature data if it exceeds some threshold, for example. So again, now I'm not distributing data that isn't needed in the system, so I'm using the network and processor resources in that system much more efficiently. And then high availability, again, in a real-time system, you know, if that sensor goes away, I either need to fail over to a backup sensor or at least a process or application that depends on that sensor needs to know about it. So how do I determine, you know, if a sensor, you know, isn't working anymore or isn't working well anymore? So I configure basically the liveliness, so it's the rate at which I need to see that that sensor is alive to determine it's alive, and then ownership and ownership strength is sort of the rules about how do you fail over to a backup sensor. When do you determine that the primary is down and move over to a backup? So this is some of the example of real-time quality of service that by implementing all of this in the infrastructure, it greatly simplifies your application logic, making the systems much more scalable and, again, keeps application-specific knowledge or algorithm-specific knowledge from creeping back into your applications and your integration logic for scalability reasons. The next key is to use communications middleware to govern and manage the interactions between different services or applications. And the role of the middleware here is to provide an instantiation of the data model. And while the data model provides a means for different developers or integrators to achieve understand the data so they can achieve semantic interoperability, the role of middleware is to make sure that you actually have technical interoperability between different systems. So in other words, you might know that, you know, speed is measured in kilometers per hour, but if I've got a big endian system sending data to a little endian system, you need to make sure that you're actually interpreting, sending the right speed, and that, you know, 100 knots doesn't get translated into minus 4,000 knots, for example, when it goes over the wire. So what middleware provides and communications middleware provides is that ability to enforce the quality of service contracts that you specified in your system, the ability to provide technical interoperability so that data is interpreted the same across systems regardless of the programming language that the applications might be implemented in, the operating system that they're running on, you know, the CPU type. If I'm on a 64-bit CPU and an 8-bit CPU, I still need to communicate with each other. Applications still need to communicate with each other. It also decouples applications from the underlying transporter network that's being used. So applications, it should be transparent to an application or service, whether it's communicating over shared memory because it's talking to an application running on the same node, or communicating over a wide area satellite link, for example, to an application that might be halfway around the world. That shouldn't, none of that knowledge should contaminate your applications or services. That should all be handled by the infrastructure. So by using middleware, what it does is it gives you a much more evolvable, interoperable underlying architecture, so that your systems can diversify over time. You know, applications become completely independent of their implementation. And again, not just implementation in terms of how you've implemented the algorithms, but implementation in terms of programming language and platform and other attributes like that. So middleware gives you all of those capabilities. So one of the examples just is the data distribution service standard I mentioned earlier. So the DDS standard was designed specifically to implement a lot of the principles that I've talked about here today. So what DDS lets you do is it provides a standard means to enforce or implement a data model on the wire. So you can take a data model that you've defined in, you know, XML in the OMG's IDL language, or even generated from a UML model of that data, then from that data model, DDS basically ensures that applications are interoperable at the technical level, so that regardless of what platform I'm running on or what language my application is written in, it's going to interpret all of that data the same at the binary level or at the programming language level within each application. So the DDS standard itself provides a standard means to define data. It provides a standard programming interface, so a way to access that data in that shared state in the system, so those data-centric publish-subscribe interfaces, and it provides a standard protocol for interoperability on the wire. So, you know, even different applications in the system can be using different DDS implementations, and they can still interoperate with each other. And DDS also provides the means to enforce the quality of service contracts that I talked about. So it's kind of the example of the type of middleware that can be used to implement the architectural characteristics that I talked about. Then the last key is for real-time systems to implement this in a decentralized manner. So I mentioned earlier that logically the integration model looks a lot like a database, but given the nature of real-time systems is you typically don't want to deploy any central infrastructure, because central infrastructure creates a bottleneck and it's often not feasible in a real-time system. So if I've got a system that, you know, I've got to take onto the battlefield, or, you know, into a very lightweight system like an unmanned vehicle, for example, I don't want to have to put a bunch of servers in there to host databases, as an example. So the means by which you implement the system to achieve network-level scalability needs to be completely decentralized. So different services should communicate with each other in what we call a peer-to-peer manner. There shouldn't be any mandatory central points in the system through which data has to flow, because once you have central points, now you've got bottlenecks. And potential cases where, you know, data could get queued or blocked, leading to higher latency as your throughput goes up, which, as I talked about earlier, you really never want to happen in a real-time system. So while you want the logical model of a central database, physically speaking, you want to implement that in a way which is completely decentralized, so it affects the database is virtual. It's not physical, or the bus through which applications are integrated is really a virtual bus, not a physical bus. So again, to kind of compare that, you know, is an infrastructure designed for real-time systems that's decentralized really is primarily packaged in the form, you know, often even of a library that can then be just embedded in each individual application rather than, you know, a central broker or server component to it. So again, that ensures good latency regardless of how many applications or how much overall data there is in a system. And becomes very scalable at the network level, and then ensures there's no single point of failure in a system. So, for example, you know, in this picture here, if one of these applications goes down, that really doesn't have an effect on any other application in the system because no data is flowing to or from that application except for the data that specific application produces or consumes. So you can easily remove an application from a system, or an application could fail, or part of the network could become disconnected. And that doesn't lead to any failure in other parts of the system. And again, if you have real-time quality of service, you can get visibility into that failure if you care about it, but it doesn't bring anything down. Your system is still running nonstop. So you kind of contrast that to the traditional approach used in IT with centralized administration with servers. So first off, this tends to not be good for real-time systems because once you introduce servers and sort of centralized brokers or enterprise service buses or databases, you typically involve now a lot of administration, which generally you don't want. You typically are assuming you're all running in a data center, so you've got a very high bandwidth, reliable network. And again, because you're going through a central point, as data volumes go up, your latency tends to degrade. So your system as a whole isn't scalable, or even in the best cases, the only way you can scale it by throwing a lot more servers at the problem, but that then typically becomes, you know, prohibitively expensive, you know, in the rare case where you actually can't afford to start throwing hardware at the problem because you don't care about, you know, size, weight, and power, for example. And again, failover tends to be very slow in a centralized system because you've got to fail over to a backup server and maybe reload from a database, for example. So you typically don't get nonstop availability. You might have high availability, but there can often be windows of, you know, hundreds of milliseconds or often seconds or even minutes, you know, where your whole network is down. So again, won't traditionally work in a real-time system. So this is just kind of a comparison between RTI, and our software obviously implements a peer-to-peer approach, and you can see the implications just on performance here, that generally it, you know, is performing, you know, an order of magnitude or orders of magnitude better than a kind of traditional centralized approach. Another advantage of the combination of publish, subscribe, and a peer-to-peer architecture is for local area communication, you can leverage multicast, which is a feature of, you know, virtually every, if not every single, sort of modern switch. So with multicast and publish-subscribe, when a publisher sends data, it only has to send a particular data object once, and the switch itself actually replicates that data and can filter that data, sending it just to appropriate subscribers. So that significantly reduces both CPU overhead, because you're not sending data multiple times, and you're minimizing the amount of filtering that has to be done in software, as well as network overhead, because you're just sending the sample once and only sending that sample to nodes in which they may be subscribing to that data. And it keeps latency fixed regardless of how many subscribers there are to a system, because the switch is doing that replication in real time. Latency doesn't degrade as you add more subscribers to a system. So this graph is just showing an example of multicast scalability when running in a system with up to about 1,000 subscribers. And what you can see is the throughput of the system, and this is just from one application to N applications. As you move from one subscriber to almost 1,000 subscribers, there's virtually no impact on performance. So it provides an extremely efficient, scalable way to do broad data distribution in a system by leveraging the combination of publish, subscribe, multicast, and peer-to-peer networking. So just to quickly summarize sort of the key to architecting scalable real-time systems, the first is to use publish-subscribe to decouple individual applications so applications no longer need any direct knowledge of each other. They only need knowledge of the data that they produce or consume. So again, it makes the system very scalable in terms of the number and ease with which you can add different applications to a system. Use an explicit data model so developers or integrators can understand the semantics behind the data and you don't end up with a scenario where somebody is interpreting something as miles per hour and somebody is interpreting it as kilometers per second, for example, and everyone understands the reference point of data. Because if that data model isn't well-defined, then people have to start looking at application code or integration logic to see how things are connected, and again, that makes integration much more difficult and it becomes much more error-prone. Maintain a shared state within the infrastructure, so there's a single version of truth in a system, and as systems scale up and become more dynamic, the state of the system remains consistent and sane, and you don't get applications that end up out of sync with the rest of the world, and you don't have the need to inefficiently persist data in the infrastructure to ensure that applications stay consistent, so it provides a very scalable approach to integration. Make sure that the infrastructure supports explicit quality of service contracts. Again, without having explicit quality of service contracts, then what happens is quality of service requirements end up sneaking back into integration and application logic, and you now end up with having to have application awareness and individual producers and consumers again. So it's important that the infrastructure actually enforces the quality of service and provides applications with visibility into whether those quality of service requirements are being met in order to truly decouple individual real-time applications. Then use middleware to instantiate this architecture and provide the technical interoperability and decoupling from the actual network topology to go along with the semantic interoperability provided by the data model, and implement this in a decentralized way so you get network-level scalability in addition to scalability in terms of the number of components and services and applications you have to have in the system. So that's kind of a quick summary of the keys to architecting scalable real-time systems. Before we get into the Q&A, I did want to quickly just introduce RTI's solution in this space. So RTI's solution, we have a number of products that are built on a common foundation that we call the RTI Data Bus. So it implements the data-centric architecture that I talked about with data-centric publish-subscribe interfaces, enforcing quality of service contracts, and maintaining the state of the world in the infrastructure. We provide a number of means for diverse application types to access that data bus, so kind of reading from left to right here on the top. Connex Micro is our very small footprint library for small devices, so this is designed for very resource-constrained devices or for devices that have to be certified to rigorous safety standards like DO-178C now, level A, which is required for flight-critical applications in avionics, for example, by the US FAA. Connex DDS is a full implementation of the DDS standard that I described before, so it provides data-centric publish-subscribe interfaces. Connex Messaging builds on Connex DDS and provides additional communication integration patterns and security capabilities built on top of Connex DDS, really for general purpose application use. And what Connex Integrator does, shown on the right there, is it provides really two capabilities. One is the means to integrate applications in a data-centric manner that weren't originally designed, say, with DDS or data-centric technology. So it provides a mediation capability to allow you to integrate existing or legacy applications in a data-centric manner. Or even in the case where you might have multiple data-centric applications, what it does is lets you mediate between different data models that they might be using. So it can decouple sort of the data model that's used for integration from the specific data view that any individual application might have by reconciling either syntactic or semantic differences in the data that's being used by different subsystems or systems in a system of systems. And all of these products do share a common set of tools and infrastructure services to facilitate development, testing, and integration. And, of course, designed for real-time systems, so they're all fully embeddable, support plug-and-play operation so they can run autonomously without needing centralized administration, enforce real-time quality of service, and run over a wide variety of networks. So they don't, we don't depend, for example, on having TCP or IP or Ethernet or anything like that. We can run over a very wide variety of networks. So it's just a quick overview of RTI's solution. So if you'd like to learn more either about data-centric architecture or RTI solution, you know, please don't hesitate to contact RTI and all of our local contact information. We have offices around the world, is on our website. We have a number of downloads that might be of interest. So kind of the little picture on the upper right there is of what we call our Shapes demo. So this is an interactive application that lets you explore these data-centric concepts that I talked about in an interactive way. So no programming required, but it lets you see what we sort of mean when we talk about publish, subscribe, maintaining state in the infrastructure, enforcing real-time quality of service. It gives you an interface to kind of explore all those capabilities and see how you can leverage them in a system. We do have a free, full free trial of our application as well. You can download if you want to use this in practice. We also have quite a bit of white papers, other webinars and videos on our website as well in the resources section. So please don't hesitate to go check out some of the other materials we have. And with that, I want to thank everyone for joining us today, and I'll turn it back to you, Mike.
Thanks, David. We have time for some questions, and I just would like to remind the audience, if you do have a question, please enter it into the box on your screen, and we'll try to get to that before the end of the session today. So, David, the first question is, how do you maintain a consistent state with a decentralized network topology?
Yeah, maybe what I'll do to answer that question is if I can scroll back to a slide here. So we really do it in two ways. Basically, if you look at this is the way RTI implements it in our infrastructure, is we basically have a library that you can embed in each service or application. And what that library does, if you kind of consider that the part depicted in orange here, is within each application we maintain a cache, effectively. You can look at it sort of as a very lightweight in-memory database of the data that's either being published or subscribed by that specific application. So if you're a publisher, you're maintaining a cache of the data that you've published so that when a subscriber joins the system, it can basically get its snapshot from that authoritative cache that the publisher itself has maintained. And then it will then create its own cache for access by local applications. In cases in which you don't, for either efficiency reasons or in which publishers might have very short life cycles, we do provide what we call a persistent service that can run anywhere on your network, and you may have any number of persistent services that, you know, basically acts as a database or server for late joining applications that want to get data without going back to the original application, or because the original application that published that data might no longer be there. But unlike the centralized approach, a persistent service doesn't have to run centralized on any specific node. You can have any number of persistent services for both load balancing and high availability purposes running across the network. And I don't show that here on this particular slide. But basically, there's two ways we do that, by caching data locally and then by using persistent services to basically keep a cache of data around your network.
Thanks, David. Next question is, the architecture approach is sensible, where all equipments are new, but many systems use legacy equipment that might not always utilize DDS. I guess that's a statement, but you could try and respond to that.
Sure. So if I capture that correctly, so I think that was really the purpose of the product I referred to here called Connect Integrator. So we certainly, you know, realize that most legacy systems haven't traditionally used this approach. So basically, this is something one could build themselves or use our Connect Integrator product as the starting point for. But basically, it provides a mediation capability between legacy applications or existing applications or services that don't use the data-centric approach, and basically mediates between that, you know, and a data-centric approach for overall integration. So, for example, our Connect Integrator basically includes an adapter software development kit as part of it. So even if you're using your own protocols in your existing or legacy systems, you can basically now build your own adapter to translate between those legacy protocols and a underlying data-centric infrastructure.
Okay, thank you. The next question is, does RTI DDS support the data-centric model? Is there a security model for the data-centric model to control which applications can support CRUD operations?
Yes, there is. So we do in the Connext messaging product that I referred to, basically provides access control to individual applications to basically authenticate whether they're allowed to publish or subscribe to data on a particular topic in the system.
Okay. And how does this relate to service-oriented architecture?
So I think, you know, different people may mean different things by service-oriented architecture. So I think this adheres to all the abstract principles of a service-oriented architecture. So, you know, often we and our customers have referred to this as a means to implement a real-time service-oriented architecture. Sometimes when folks say service-oriented architecture, they're referring to a specific set of protocols used to implement it, such as, you know, SOAP and WSDL, for example. So again, using our Connect Integrator product, you know, one can interface between sort of a service-oriented architecture implemented using traditional IT technologies and a real-time service-oriented architecture implemented using the data-centric publish-subscribe approach. But, you know, on the data-centric publish-subscribe side, it's adhering to all the standard service-oriented architecture principles like loose coupling and governance of interactions between applications, for example, and use of abstract interfaces. In this case, it's defined using your data model, you know, which is independent of its implementation in any specific application. So, you know, at the highest level, it adheres to all the service-oriented architecture principles.
Okay. Is it possible to have a local database?
Yes. So one of the capabilities, I guess I somewhat skipped over, but one of the features that we provide actually as part of the Connect Integrator product is actually the ability to use a standard relational database, which could be an in-memory database, to maintain a local copy of all of that state. So, you know, while we have a built-in in-memory database effectively in the product for maintaining that state, you can actually store that database in a standard SQL database. And we support both kind of traditional databases as well as in-memory databases for that. So if you want to use a conventional database, you can. Of course, with this approach, it's fully distributed, so you're not required to use a single centralized database. You can actually use multiple databases distributed around the network with, you know, an RTI's implementation, the RTI data bus used to basically synchronize the state across those independent relational databases.
Okay. Excuse me. Okay, the next question I'll ask, there's two questions. I'll ask the first one. When you were developing this infrastructure, did you have any security issue considerations?
Yes, I think, you know, security is clearly a key requirement of the type of system we've talked about here in real-time systems, because these are the systems that are, you know, controlling critical infrastructure, you know, both critical sort of at the national level as well as critical infrastructure in terms of, you know, factory automation. You know, as well as a lot of defense electronics. So security is really, you know, a foremost concern in the product, which is why, you know, we do build security capabilities into the product. In addition, we do provide, you know, hooks in the product as well for folks that have existing security infrastructures that they want to interface with. We actually provide means to delegate things like authentication to the application if you don't want to use our built-in techniques, for example.
And then the second question from this attendee was, is there a possibility that the message in the system overload? Is there a possibility for overload? Messages in the system would overload. Any methods to solve that? I guess what they're saying is if you get too high of a volume of messages, is there a possibility of creating system overload?
Yeah, I think, you know, if the system, you know, a specific, you know, node or processor isn't able to keep up with the volume, or the volume is too high for the underlying network to support, that is certainly possible. You know, but a key capability, you know, that real-time quality of service provides is at least giving applications visibility into the fact that the system is unable to keep up with data. So again, just as important as, you know, making the best effort to deliver all the data is letting applications know when that data isn't being delivered. And I'd say that's one of the key, you know, key differences between a real-time system and a traditional IT application is a traditional IT application doesn't really care. I mean, typically a system just makes its best effort to keep up and queues data or even loses data when it can't. And a key for a real-time system is getting that visibility into how the system is behaving. So basically each application should specify its constraints using a real-time quality of service contract, which the infrastructure should make its best effort to enforce given the capabilities of the underlying really hardware infrastructure for the most part, network, CPUs, for example. And in the event that the middleware can't maintain the quality of service contracts, then it needs to let the applications know so they don't think everything's running fine when, in fact, deadlines in the system aren't being met or the system's being overwhelmed. So that's done via the quality of service contracts. Now, RTI also provides a tool, so applications certainly have the ability to know. One of the tools we provide, we call RTI Monitor, actually provides sort of a graphical console that a system operator or integrator can use to kind of look at basically the health of a system to see, you know, are all the requirements being met, you know, on a central display, as well as, you know, are there cases where the requirements are being met, but it looks like messages are getting backed up. So, for example, queues are getting deep because you're sort of at the edge of what your network could support, for example. So that's okay. One of the capabilities provided by our RTI Monitor tool.
All right, thanks. One last question before we'll have to wrap up. Is the persistent server part of the DDS standard?
Yes, it is.
Okay, good. I thought that might be a short answer. So just want to thank David and RTI for providing us with this informative webinar today, and also thank the audience. We had great participation with the questions, and if we didn't get time to answer your question, somebody will be following up with you after the webinar. remind the audience that the webcast will be posted online at the URL shown on your screen. Should be online by the end of today. And you can also note that an audio-only podcast version will be made available. And you'll be able to search on iTunes using embedded_ecast and find all of Open System Media's webinars available there for download as MP3s. So thank you again to David, to RTI, and thank you all for attending, and have a great day.